Did you hear about that?
You don't believe that, do you?
Did Pope Pius XII help Hitler?
The Pope didn't help Hitler.
I read a book that said so.
You don't believe that, do you?
How can a man be infallible?
Does that mean the Pope is perfect?
Is that true?
What about the Spanish Inquisition?
Well, I heard that Peter never went to Rome.
Our teacher told us.
I saw it on television.
Is that true?
Pope fiction.
With your host, Patrick Madrid.
In the early Christian church, the bishops were all equal. They say in the Middle Ages that the Church of Rome decided that the Bishop of Rome should have authority over all the other bishops. I think that the Church of Rome just won more political power.
Hello, I'm Patrick Madrid, publisher of Envoy Magazine and author of the book Pope Fiction. In this series, we're analyzing many of the common myths and misconceptions about the papacy that are floating around out there. In the last few episodes, we looked at several Pope fictions that were biblical in nature. Today, we're going to investigate three claims made against the papacy that are built around historical issues. The first of these three Pope fictions is what I call the Canon 6 of the Council of Nicaea argument. It goes like this. Canon 6 of the Council of Nicaea in AD 325 decreed, "Let the ancient customs in Egypt, Libya, and Pentapolis prevail, that the Bishop of Alexandria has jurisdiction in all of these, since this is also the custom for the Bishop of Rome. Likewise, in Antioch and the other provinces, let the churches retain their privileges." We see then that the early Christians recognized Rome as one church among equals, is the way the argument is raised, not one as having a greater authority than the other ancient churches. Now, this fiction is particularly popular, and it's an objection that's raised by what you might call scholarly opponents of the papacy, both Protestant and Orthodox. So we have to recognize that this is being advanced to demonstrate that the Roman Church's claim of primacy was actually a later development that occurred in the Middle Ages, not in the early church. Now, again, I'm emphasizing that's the argument. They're arguing that in the early church, there was no primacy of jurisdiction in the Roman Church. To answer this fiction, we need to read Canon 6 in its context and in light of the rest of the canons and with an understanding of the situation behind the promulgation of this canon at the Council of Nicaea. First, let's notice the purpose of the canon. It lays out the jurisdiction of the Bishop of Alexandria. Why? Because that's the custom, it says, for the Bishop of Rome. If you read the canon, we see that it is anchoring the validity of this Alexandrian custom based on the authority of the Roman custom. This alone is a strong indication of the normative nature of Roman tradition. Despite what some opponents of the Roman Catholic Church would like to claim, Canon 6 is actually speaking specifically about Alexandria, not about Rome. It makes no addition or subtraction to the authority of the Roman bishop, and it really only alludes to the Roman Church in order to validate a custom in the Diocese of Alexandria. In this way, it isn't limiting or curtailing the authority of Rome. It merely uses Roman tradition for the rule as the rule to establish what's going on in Alexandria. But there's another way to look at the words of the canon. Let Alexandria retain its jurisdiction because it is the custom of Rome for her to have that jurisdiction. With this understanding, the Roman custom referred to is the recognition of Alexandria's jurisdiction. There's a compelling exegetical case for this interpretation in a book called The Sixth Nicene Canon and the Papacy by James Laughlin. This appeared in the American Quarterly Review back in 1880. We have to recall, according to this argument, that the reason why this canon needed to be promulgated was that the heretic Meletius was usurping the authority of the Alexandrian Patriarch. He was ordaining bishops, he was convening synods. Now, this canon was promulgated at the Council of Nicaea to reassert the authority of the Patriarch of Alexandria. So with this in mind, we can reread the canon and the council's argument, which was aimed at Meletius, and it was the basis of this argument being the custom of Rome, or the custom of the Bishop of Rome. That was the basis for this argument against Meletius. For this argument to have any weight, Roman tradition must be held to be normative, and the custom of the Roman bishop must be authoritative. And if this weren't the case, Meletius would merely dismiss this reference to a foreign bishop. So it's a far more likely interpretation of Canon 6 to see this as using the authority of Rome to bolster the authority of the Patriarch of Alexandria. Really, far from refuting the Roman Catholic Church's claims of papal primacy, this argument from Canon 6 at the Council of Nicaea actually strongly supports it. But there's more. Have a look at Canon 6 again in its entirety, and we'll see that the wording is this: let the ancient customs in Egypt, Libya, and Pentapolis prevail. Those are cities in the region. So that the Bishop of Alexandria will have jurisdiction in all of these, since this is the custom for the Bishop of Rome also. Likewise, in Antioch and the other provinces, let the churches retain their privileges, and this is to be universally understood, that if anyone is made a bishop without the consent of the metropolitan bishop, the great synod has declared that such a man ought not to be bishop. If, however, two or three bishops shall, from natural love of contradiction, oppose the common suffrage of the rest, it is reasonable, in accordance with ecclesiastical law, that the choice of the majority should prevail. Just what is the jurisdiction mentioned in this canon? Is it some kind of absolute authority over the provinces, hinting at some kind of confederation of equal churches? No, not at all. If you look at the second half of the canon, you see that this jurisdiction refers primarily, at least, to the authority to ordain bishops. Father Hugh Barber, a patristic scholar, recently wrote an article called Ancient Baptists and Other Myths in Envoy magazine. And in that he says, notice that after laying out the territory for each of the metropolitans, the canon of the council explains what is to take place within those limits, the selection and ordination of bishops. This point also fits the context of the preceding canons, which are paraphrased here. Canon number 4, bishops are to be chosen by the bishops of their province, and their choice is then to be ratified by the metropolitan bishop who has jurisdiction over that area. Canon 5, those who are excommunicated by one bishop are not to be reinstituted by a bishop of a different territory. Every province should have regular synods to decide these issues. Canon 6, the metropolitans have jurisdiction over their respective territories. No one is to be made a bishop without the final approval of the metropolitan. So notice the function of Canon 6 in the context of the preceding two canons. It sets out territorial boundaries for more efficient administration. Recall that the Pope is also the Bishop of the city of Rome. He has a special administrative jurisdiction over Rome. Whereas, for example, the Bishop of New York has the same jurisdiction over New York, the Bishop of Alexandria over Alexandria, etc. But this is not to say that the Roman bishop has no authority over the church as a whole. These are two different kinds of jurisdictions. In canons 4 through 6, we see that the council was dealing with issues in local churches. They were not dealing with the authority of the universal church. To claim otherwise is to twist the canon, to cite from it selectively, and to ignore its context. Unfortunately, that's the case in many Pope fictions. This next Pope fiction we'll look at has to do with Pope Gregory the Great and the incident in which he rebuked the patriarch John the Faster for using a title Universal Bishop. Now, Pope Gregory the Great wrote to the Archbishop of Constantinople, John the Faster, for his attempt to call himself the Universal Bishop. Gregory claimed that anyone who called himself by this title was being impious and blasphemous, and he really made a strong case as to why this title of Universal Bishop shouldn't be used. So the Catholic claim, the Pope fiction goes, that the Pope is the universal pastor is contrary to the early church. If we were to encapsulate this Pope fiction in a single sentence, we could say that the argument is used to try to say that the Pope has no jurisdiction over the other bishops in the rest of the world, and it uses this letter by Pope Gregory the Great to try to make this claim. The argument is sometimes raised by our Eastern Orthodox brothers, who want to show that the papacy today, complete with its titles and various trappings of authority, is inconsistent somehow with the nature of the papacy as we would see it in the early church, for example, in the day of Pope Gregory the Great. Now, here's how we respond to this. This episode of Pope Gregory the Great criticizing this Eastern patriarch for using the title Universal Bishop seems to be a good tool for debunking Catholic claims, at least on the surface. but in fact it's not. Whenever we're faced with an objection like this, it's always beneficial for us to define our terms first. And in this case, what we needed to understand is exactly what Pope Gregory was condemning when he forbade John the Faster to use the term universal bishop. Two things can be said to have been meant by this phrase. Scholars have dug through these letters, and they know exactly what Pope Gregory meant. First, universal bishop can mean either a bishop over the entire church, in other words, universal jurisdiction, while not denying the individual authority of the local bishops, or it can imply that the bishop who claims this title sees himself as a bishop of all other bishops, kind of a super bishop, to whom all the other bishops must look to as their bishop. Now, this would imply that the other bishops of the world were not really bishops in the fullest sense, and that there was no single bishop for a diocese. Rather, there was a single bishop for the whole world. Now, when Gregory attacked the title universal bishop, as it was being used by John the Faster, the evidence shows that he was condemning this later definition, not the former one about universal jurisdiction. This is clear from his words in one of his epistles, where he says, "If one, such as John the Faster, supposes he is the universal bishop, it remains that you," speaking to the other bishops, "are not bishops." Now, Gregory was not objecting to the term universal bishop as if it meant that the Pope didn't have universal primacy among the College of Bishops. Rather, he was reproaching the arrogance that he saw by the Patriarch of Constantinople at that time to arrogate to himself this title, implying that he was the bishop of all other bishops. Furthermore, Gregory didn't object to the idea of the Pope having universal jurisdiction over the whole church. Now, this is something that many non-Catholics will try to assert. His own actions show that he held to the belief of universal jurisdiction for the Pope. And this is evident from the many epistles that he wrote in which he would admonish or instruct, he would direct, rebuke, encourage, and in general guide with a firm but friendly hand the bishops of the various churches around the world. Let me give you some examples. In his epistle 81, Pope Gregory restored Bishop Maximus back to communion with the church. Obviously, Pope Gregory had the power to excommunicate another bishop. And the fact that Maximus came back to repent shows that he too recognized that the Roman pontiff had that power. In Epistle 17, Gregory intervened in the affairs of the church at Firmum, releasing a parishioner there from a debt that was owed to that church. Here again is evidence that he had jurisdiction over that church. Otherwise, he would have no authority to forgive the debt of someone on the church's behalf. Furthermore, his decision was adhered to by that church. If the notion of the Pope of Rome having a special authority in the church that extended beyond the borders of his own diocese was truly alien to the early church, you can be certain that churches like Firmum would have howled to high heavens that the Bishop of Rome was overstepping his authority by meddling in their affairs. But that never happened. In Epistle 10, Pope Gregory discussed the qualities necessary for candidates for bishop to be considered suitable for the position. And he asked his brother bishops to follow these guidelines in their choices of bishop. He gave a thumbs down to some candidates for bishop, and others he approved. Obviously, Pope Gregory had recognized and the others around him recognized his authority regarding policy on who couldn't and who could be raised to the episcopacy. In another epistle, Gregory showed the authority of the Holy See, which represents Peter, the Prince of the Apostles. He believed that no canonical law has any validity whatsoever without the authority and consent of the Apostolic See, referring to Rome. In his Epistle 59, Pope Gregory intervened into the affairs of another church regarding the disciplining of another bishop. And it is exceedingly doubtful whether he says such things to us sincerely, or in fact because he is being attacked by his fellow bishops, or if he was saying that he was subject to the Apostolic See. This is Gregory speaking here. He's talking about a bishop saying it's doubtful whether or not he's being sincere. We don't know whether he's doing it to protect himself, to do this, or because he's appealing to an Apostolic See. If any fault is found in bishops, I know not what bishop is not subject to the apostolic see. But when no fault requires it to be otherwise, all according to the principle of humility are equal. Nevertheless, Pope Gregory goes on, do you speak with the aforesaid most eloquent Martin, referring to a bishop, as seems good to your fraternity? For if it is for you to consider what should be done, and we have replied to you briefly on the case, we ought not to believe indiscriminately men that are even unknown to us. If, however, you, who have seen him before, you in person, are of the opinion that anything more definite should be said to him, we commit this to your charity, referring to this bishop he's writing to, being sure of your love in the grace of Almighty God, and what you regard without doubt as having been done by us. There are three significant points in this passage. First, Gregory notes that all bishops are subject to the apostolic see. Recall that he's speaking to a bishop about another bishop giving him instructions. Second, Gregory delegates his authority in the punishment of that erring bishop. And third, Gregory is obviously seen as holding a higher position than these other bishops, for the erring bishop appealed to him, and the other bishops are awaiting his decision regarding the punishment or correction for that bishop. In Epistle 111, St. Gregory said, this he did as knowing such reverence to be paid by the faithful to the apostolic see, that what had been settled by its decree, no molestation of unlawful usurpation would thereafter shake. For though what has once been sanctioned by the authority of the apostolic see, the Roman bishop, has no lack of validity, yet we do, over and above, once more, corroborate by our authority in all respects all things that were ordained by our predecessor for quite a while in this matter. Gregory claimed that the decrees of the Roman See were unchangeable. Clearly, then, they are to be considered the final authority. In his Epistle 12, he says, last but certainly not least, for as to what they say about the Church of Constantinople, who can doubt that it is subject to the Apostolic See? As both the most pious Lord the Emperor and our brother the Bishop of that city continually acknowledge. Yet if this or any other church has anything that is good, I am prepared in what is good to imitate even my inferiors. That's a strong word he used there. Back to Gregory. While prohibiting them from unlawful things. According to Pope Gregory the Great, the Apostolic See, the Bishop of Rome, has authority over all other churches and bishops, even Constantinople. Now, of course, Constantinople was an extremely important diocese within the church in his day. In his writings, if we read through his epistles and examine exactly what he was saying to these other bishops and other churches, we see that there is no hint in his mind of some sort of equality in authority between the Bishop of Rome and the bishops of other dioceses when it came to universal jurisdiction. For Pope Gregory the Great, the other churches and the other bishops were what he referred to as the inferiors of the Roman See. Now, let me stop there for a minute. That word inferior is being used by Pope Gregory the Great to explain a status relative one to the other in the order of authority. He wasn't saying, for example, that a bishop of another diocese was inferior mentally or he was less holy. He wasn't in some way putting down that other bishop. The word inferior and the word superior in this context, it's a technical ecclesiastical term. And sometimes you'll hear it referred to in religious orders, where a priest may say, I need to check with my superior to see if I can do this. Or a religious sister may say, our superior has told us that we need to move to a different house. It's in that sense that the term superiors and inferiors are being used by Pope Gregory the Great. Now, let's summarize what's going on with this objection to Pope Gregory the Great's use of these kinds of terms. In his letter to John the Faster, Pope Gregory was forbidding another bishop to use a term that would give an erroneous theological implication. Or to put it a different way, what he was saying to this bishop was, if by this phrase, this title that you've taken for yourself, universal bishop, if you mean that you are the bishop of other bishops, and that the bishop of a given diocese doesn't have real authority as bishop, then that's wrong. And he refers to that as being impious and wicked. And it would be, because that would be contrary to Catholic ecclesiology and the whole idea of what a bishop is as a successor of the apostles. Pope Gregory Rather was simply saying that this title can't be used in that sense, but he certainly did not reject the idea that the Pope has universal jurisdiction over the whole church. It's important to finally point out that when we see Pope Gregory the Great using these epistles to give instructions or to admonish other bishops, he wasn't doing it as a tyrant or an overlord. Rather, what he was doing was he was exercising this authority that we saw in an earlier episode of Pope Fiction. In, as the successor of St. Peter, he was confirming and strengthening his brothers, his brother bishops. He was not their bishop, but he was the chief bishop among them, helping confirm and guide them and strengthen them in their sacred ministry of shepherding the flock. Now that brings us to our third of our Pope Fictions in this show. And in this third one, we're really going to sort of tie together an amalgamation of arguments that are used against the papacy in an historical sense. That argument or that fiction could be put this way. The idea of the papacy, as we understand it today in this modern era, is radically different from the way the Bishop of Rome understood his office in the early church. Sometimes you'll see this phrased as the papacy is a development that came about in the Middle Ages, and it wasn't until then that the papacy that we understand really took root. This is actually not true, and it's a good jumping off point for us to have just talked about Pope Gregory the Great, because there we see in the early medieval church a pope exercising authority, writing letters, giving admonition to other bishops in very much the same way that subsequent popes have down through the ages. And our answer to this more generic pope fiction about the early church not having a papacy the way we understand it today, our answer would be couched in these terms. What we need to do is to look at what the other bishops in the early church said and did with regard to the authority of the Bishop of Rome. And let's see what the bishops of Rome said and did with regard to their authority in their diocese and in the dioceses around the world. Each individual bishop is a successor to the apostles, and the papacy in no way jeopardizes or thwarts that. Each bishop has his direct authority as bishop, as shepherd of his flock, by virtue of the fact that he is a direct successor of the apostles. The Bishop of Rome, a bishop obviously, and someone who is a direct successor of the apostles, he has the same episcopal authority in his diocese, but there is an added authority of jurisdiction, as we spoke about a moment ago, that shows that he is to fulfill in each successive pontificate the role of strengthening and confirming his brother bishops. So when we're faced with this third pope fiction, this idea, this kind of nebulous charge that the early church didn't understand the papacy the way we understand it today, the easiest way to respond to it is to simply go to the historical record and point out how pope after pope after pope lived and worked and carried out his apostolic ministry in such a way as to show that he had authority. Now, that doesn't mean that every pope exercised his authority in the best way. It also doesn't mean that every pope exercised his authority in the times that he should have, or at moments of crisis in the church, when the church needed the pope to step forward and do something. Simply it means, though, that the popes understood that they had a unique authority, and some wielded it better than others. Well, that's about all the time we have for today. In our next episode of Pope Fiction, we'll take an inside look at three specific popes that some papal critics claim taught heresy. That would be Pope Liberius, Pope Honorius, and Pope Vigilius. They'll be on the hot seat next time on Pope Fiction. Until then, please join me in praying for the health and strength of our Holy Father, the Pope. I'm Patrick Madrid, publisher of Envoy Magazine and author of the book Pope Fiction, and I wish you all the best in Christ.
On this mountain the Lord of hosts will prepare a banquet of rich food. On this mountain he will remove the mourning veil. The Lord will destroy death, remove the cloud of sorrow, wipe away every tear from each cheek, everywhere on earth. On this mountain the Lord of hosts will prepare a banquet of rich food. On this mountain he will remove the mourning veil. The Lord is our God, in whom we trust. He will silence the cry of the heart. We exult in his saving hand. On this mountain the Lord of hosts will prepare a banquet of rich food. On this mountain he will.